Did Mike's appearance move the needle in Texas? And if so, which direction? Assessing the debate as we barrel towards Super Tuesday. That's today on the Texas Standard.
Texas Standard is a production of KUT Austin, KERA North Texas, Houston Public Media, and Texas Public Radio in San Antonio. With support from Rand Group, software delivered as promised. No surprises.
I'm David Brown in the Texas Standard Newsroom. Other stories we're tracking: how reactions to the coronavirus have created what doctors are calling an infodemic thanks to social media. Omar Gayaga on viral takes about a medical crisis. Amarillo by morning? Not if by that you mean a break in a big-time labor deadlock there. Details plus why some flights out of Brownsville have asylum attorneys alarmed. All those stories and more as the Texas Standard gets started right after this. No matter where you are, it's Texas Standard time on this 20th day of February 2020. I'm David Brown. Great to have you with us. So how do you look, Texas? Did you see it? The Democratic candidate who's pinned his national aspirations for president on a launch pad colloquially known as the Lone Star State was up there on a stage in Nevada duking it out for the first time among the five others still left standing among the initial parade of Trump challengers. There was Amy Klobuchar, the senator from Minnesota, Elizabeth Warren, the senator from Massachusetts. There was the former mayor of South Bend, Indiana, Pete Buttigieg. There was a former vice president, too, Joe Biden. Let's see, there was the candidate polling the strongest right now among the Democrats. That would be Bernie Sanders. And then there's Mike, a.k.a. former New York Mayor Michael Bloomberg, making his debut in the presidential debate arena and not escaping unbruised, it is worth noting. His campaign acknowledged that their boss, who spent hundreds of millions of his personal fortune on making a big splash on Super Tuesday, had not prepared for this debate. That's one way to explain his performance, or lack thereof, depending on your perspective. But let's be clear, his rapid rise in the polls, landing him at the number two spot without even being on the ballot in the earliest primary and caucus states, had all of the veterans in the 2020 Democratic field out with knives sharpened. It was, by most measures, the closest thing yet to a political street fight among the Democratic contenders in this election cycle. But whether it made a difference, especially in Texas, that's the question, one worth special consideration, as Texans are already casting their early presidential primary ballots statewide leading up to March 3rd, Super Tuesday. Let's get an assessment from someone who watches this stuff quite closely indeed. James Riddlesberger is a political science professor at Texas Christian University, TCU. Dr. Riddlesberger, welcome back to The Standard.
Glad to be here.
I think that was one of the more heated debates we've seen this presidential election cycle, and looked like Mayor Bloomberg was in the crosshairs, didn't it?
Yes, it was. I mean, this is a high-stakes debate. What's happening here is all six of these candidates, or really just five of them, because I think Sanders is well-positioned, but the other five are all in a position where they're jockeying to make it through the next stage of the winnowing process. And so they're selectively targeting the people who they think are more likely to keep them from making it to the next winnowing stage. So that's what was going on last night.
What was fascinating to me was that Elizabeth Warren, who had not been really discussed much in the run-up to this debate, had all been, you know, sort of focused on Biden and his sort of firewall in South Carolina and how Mike Bloomberg was going to do. It turned out that she had, I mean, she was being branded the comeback kid last night for taking on Bloomberg.
Yeah, I mean, there's no question that she showed her debate prowess last night and obviously led the charge in terms of trying to stave off the latecomer to the race, who I think it's safe to say the other five candidates all kind of resent the fact that he's simply skipped the first four contests and hopes to be a latecomer coming in and taking the nomination after the others have been working so hard. So the one thing that all five of them agree on is that they're not wild about him.
No, indeed. But does it mean anything substantively? I mean, they tried to come at him for his remarks apparently or allegedly made about women and about his stop and frisk stand and his defense of that over the years. Did any of that land?
I don't know that it did or not. I have quit handicapping debates a long time ago because, you know, you can't really score the debates. That's not what the point is. The point is, what do people hear coming out of those debates? Mm-hmm. And, of course, it's the spin on the debates that probably makes more difference than the debates themselves.
Interesting.
Because only the passionate people, many of whom have already made up their minds before they listen to the debate, are likely to listen to the debate at all. The less dedicated voters, and that's a majority of voters, are not going to dedicate 2 hours to listening to a bunch of politicians yell at each other.
Well, as people sort of harden in their positions, this is something that you just made reference to, I wonder, amid this great sorting, whether or not these debates serve any real function. I mean, you know, you find people sort of wanting to consider themselves more centrist and moving away from one position or another, or trying to rationalize, hey, what happens if, in fact, Bernie Sanders comes out the party nominee? Can I back this person if I am a centrist and not a progressive? Is something like that going on, do you think?
Well, I think that's clearly the case. I mean, people are trying to figure out what is going on, and that's kind of the purpose of the debates, not who wins or loses, mm-hmm. but can you hear a candidate making an articulate argument? Could you see yourself supporting that person if that person becomes the nominee of the party? And so I think in the long run, that's probably the importance of these debates, rather than trying to score who wins and who loses on a debate basis. Now, we're getting to a critical point, because remember that if you add together Iowa, New Hampshire, Nevada, and South Carolina, all of them combined only have 2/3 of the delegates that Texas has. Mm-hmm. And on Super Tuesday, we're going to pick 10 times the delegates that we've picked in all the early contests combined. So it's heating up now. We're getting to a real stage where it makes a difference where the candidates are strategically. And that's the reason you saw such a high stakes performance last night. And so trying to kind of figure out what that may mean over the next 3 weeks, I think is the big money question.
James Riltzberger is a political science professor at Texas Christian University. Professor, thanks again.
You're welcome.
Some asylum seekers who would normally be allowed to stay in the United States while pleading their case are now being sent to Guatemala instead. Texas Public Radio's Reynaldo Leaños Jr. reports on the flights leaving Brownsville and those trying to draw attention to the departures.
Thomas Cartwright is with the group Witness at the Border. He and dozens of protesters are outside the Brownsville South Padre Island International Airport. They're trying to peek through a chain-link fence to see migrants being escorted onto a plane.
We want the doers to know there are watchers, so that nothing is done in the darkness.
As Cartwright leans against the fence and takes out his phone to try and record, a large white airport shuttle parks in front of him, blocking his view. This isn't the first time airport vehicles have tried to keep protesters from seeing into the airport.
One day, I think there were, I counted, roughly 10 large vehicles, fuel trucks, tugs, that they place strategically around to block our view.
In the last year, the Trump administration has changed the rules around asylum through a number of new policies. In July, the U.S. signed an agreement with Guatemala that allows migrants who are seeking asylum here to instead be sent to the Central American country. So far, 634 asylum seekers, all of them Honduran or Salvadoran, have been sent to Guatemala. The Trump administration says it's a safe place for migrants to seek asylum, but immigrant rights activists say it's not only unsafe, but also one of the main countries asylum seekers are fleeing.
These people fled a situation most likely that threatened their lives, and we're flying them right back into those places where their lives are in danger.
Joshua Rubin is another protester at the airport today.
So what it must feel like to come all this distance for a lot of them to pay a lot of money to get here, to be captured and to be fast-tracked, to have asylum claims denied.
Before migrants are sent to Guatemala, they are provided little information about where they are going and why. That's according to Charnia Krishnaswamy. She's the America's Advocacy Director for Amnesty International USA. She's in Guatemala to document the implementation of the new agreement.
not even understanding that that's where you're going, and only realizing it upon landing. And that complete lack of orientation, that complete lack of counseling, I think exacerbates existing traumas and creates new ones.
Krishna Swamy has visited shelters where some migrants are staying in Guatemala. She says the shelters are under-resourced and that there isn't room for everyone.
It's important to remember that these are folks who, you know, were woken up at 1 a.m. for processing. They usually arrive at the airport around 10 or 11 in the morning. So the individuals pass through the reception center. They're told that they have 72 hours basically to decide whether they want to seek asylum in Guatemala, whether they want to accept voluntary return.
Krishna Swamy also says that only a few migrants have decided to apply for asylum in Guatemala or to accept the alternative, to be sent back to their home country. Most of the nearly 600 migrants, she says, are now simply unaccounted for. Back at the airport, Diane Sondi, an activist from Brooklyn, New York, says she was distressed to see young people on a bus raising their hand to the windows to show protesters that they were in handcuffs.
When the police came to remove us from the area, I asked them how they slept at night and how they would feel if this were their children and their families and they were being torn apart. They wouldn't even look us in the eye.
The protesters said they're in this for the long haul and will continue to be on the border for as long as they can. The Department of Homeland Security has not responded to multiple requests for comment and has provided no data on how many people have been sent to Guatemala under the agreement. Similar asylum cooperative agreements are expected to go into effect in El Salvador and Honduras. I'm Reynaldo Leaños Jr. in Brownsville.
Joining us here in the studio, it's our social media editor, Wells Dunbar. What are folks talking about on social media, Wells?
Well, folks still talking about the fireworks from last night's Democratic debate. Yes, specifically that shellacking Michael Bloomberg took primarily from Elizabeth Warren in his first televised debate. The New York media magnate repeatedly hit over past comments about women and members of the LGBT community, non-disclosure agreements, silencing former employees, and more. On our Facebook page, Josh Fredman says it was probably the most aggressive presidential debate I've ever seen. It certainly gave voters a clear sense of what each candidate stands for. And Dallas Hall says Amy Klobuchar really lost me with her snark aimed at Pete Buttigieg, who continues to impress. For my wife and I, it's between him and Sanders. Personally, I like Bernie's message, but I fear it may be too progressive to be competitive in a general election. However, Enrique Lozano says Sanders is already winning, pointing there to his front-runner status. And just boomeranging back to Warren there, seeing lots of videos, sort of supercuts circulating on Twitter and Facebook this morning, showing some of her, kind of billing it as the roast hosted by Elizabeth Warren last night of Bloomberg and several other candidates on the stage. Really remarkable debate.
To Professor Riddlesberger's point, though, did it move the needle for you, dear listener? We'd love to hear from you if it did, especially if it did. I'd love to know you're thinking about that. Tweet us at Texas Standard. Wells Dunbar's looking for you, and he'll be back with more of your comments in 35.
Support for Texas Standard comes from the Texas Tuition Promise Fund and the Texas College Savings Plan, administered by the state of Texas. More on how each plan can help families start saving for future college expenses is at SaveNowForCollege.org.
This is the Texas Standard. I'm David Brown. Researchers in Texas are claiming a breakthrough in coronavirus research, leading to a new tool to design a vaccine. It's a 3D atomic scale map of the part of the coronavirus that infects human cells. Researchers at the University of Texas at Austin say they have a running start of sorts in trying to nail down a vaccine because they're already studying diseases in the coronavirus family. Lead researcher and associate professor Jason McClellan tells KUT News that their atomic map may also be able to help stem future coronavirus outbreaks, but they add that an actual vaccine is still likely months, perhaps a year away. More on the coronavirus and a kind of info virus in just a few minutes. You know, the best laid plans don't always work out as planned. Just north of downtown Dallas, there's a building that was supposed to be a pile of rubble. Instead, it's become a social media sensation. The former Affiliated Computer Services building was imploded over the weekend, but not completely, leaving a structure behind resembling a certain tourist attraction in Pisa, Italy. KERA's Becca Moore reports those gathering to get a good look at the spectacle are creating something of a sensation themselves.
Gerald Sesteda is bent over a canvas smeared with green and gray paint. He set up a makeshift studio on Haskell Avenue to paint the infamous Leaning Tower of Dallas.
This was a painting that wasn't going anywhere. It was like a mistake, so I thought I'd make a painting of this other mistake on this mistake, and we're just gonna make art out of it.
With his smartphone camera aimed at his creation, Sesteda also films his hands on the canvas as they recreate the building in front of him. He plans to post the video online. Nearby, Ron Johnson holds two cameras overhead to get a 3D image of the building. He likes capturing demolitions as they happen. He says it's no surprise this building's getting so much attention. It's the only one he's ever seen stay standing after an implosion.
It looks so unusual, and it's like, with all of our modern technology, sometimes things go wrong.
A crane and wrecking ball will finish what the explosive started and tear down what's left in the coming days. Until then, photographer Ralph Johnson says it's great to see the community coming together, even if it is just for a good photo op.
I think we're always looking for something good or unusual. We have so much bad news in the world nowadays that when we see something like this, people can rally around it.
And with an artist's eye, even an implosion gone wrong can become something beautiful. I'm Becca Moore in Dallas.
Support for coverage of business comes from Texas Mutual Insurance Company, a workers' comp provider committed to helping companies protect their drivers on the road. More at worksafetexas.com/onthejob.
And you are listening to the Texas Standard. Copper workers in Amarillo have been striking for 4 months, and it doesn't look like there are signs of the strike ending anytime soon. The workers are protesting their company's plan to freeze pensions and increase the amount they have to pay for their health insurance. Gus Bova has been reporting on this story for the Texas Observer, and he joins us now. Gus, welcome to the Texas Standard.
Thanks for having me.
Trying to think about copper and Amarillo. I know that there is a big refinery up there, right?
Yeah, and that's the one the workers are on strike from, about 150 workers from a refinery up there. It's been there since the 70s.
And these days it's owned by a conglomerate based out of Mexico City, as I recall.
That's right. The company Asarco has been bought by Grupo Mexico, which is a massive mining and railroad conglomerate owned by the second richest man in Mexico, actually.
Why is this such an important story? Why is this one that you felt like was worth covering? I mean, there are labor disputes over issues like healthcare benefits and that sort of thing all the time.
Yeah, well, it's the fact that after 4 months on strike, there appears to be no progress still. This is just a very sort of intractable dispute that's affecting not only 150 workers in Amarillo, but about 1,500 other workers in Arizona as well. And until I went up there, there really hadn't been much coverage in the Texas media of the Amarillo side of that strike.
So what is the main contention of the workers and of the company? I mean, is the company just basically trying to freeze pensions and slash benefits, save money or what?
The company wants to save money in its American operations, its North American operations. Mm-hmm. It produces copper in South America as well for a cheaper cost per pound. And they want to cut costs, and in turn, the union wants a raise. The workers haven't had a raise in almost 11 years. They don't want to see their health insurance costs double, and they don't want their pensions frozen, right? Same thing anyone would want, I guess.
But if you've got, if you have a similar situation set up, and they're doing the refining for less cost, is it not possible that the company that owns Asarco these days might just shut down the Texas facility?
Yeah, well, their big operation's actually down in South America in Peru. Is it possible? I suppose, but it's, you know, to the best that I can tell, every part of the operation is profitable. This is a corporation that made $1.2 billion in profits in the first 9 months of last year. So could they shut it down? I suppose, but the workers in the union are arguing that that's certainly not necessary.
Well, I mean, so far they've been playing hardball, right? I mean, one wonders what the outcome is going to be and where this mm-hmm. is headed.
Yeah, a lot is likely to depend on the Federal National Labor Relations Board. They effectively need to determine whether this is what's called an unfair labor practices strike or an economic strike. If they decide the latter, then the company can legally hire permanent replacements. So right now, it's a bit of a holding pattern until that board weighs in. And this is a Trump labor board, right? So there's reason to think they could rule against the union. It's true.
What about local lawmakers? Are they getting involved? How big a deal is this in the city?
That I found interesting. In Arizona, you've got congressional support. You've got support from the Tucson mayor. But, you know, this is the Texas panhandle. These are Republican lawmakers, not normally pro-union. And so you haven't had anything from Mac Thornberry or either U.S. senator. And the city council hasn't really spoken out either. They say they want to stay out of a labor dispute, even though, you know, this is generations of Amarillo residents who've gone through this plant. I talked to multiple people. It was three generations of their family who had worked at this plant. And it's sort of a major source of, you know, middle class type wages and benefits for that community. So,
in fact, you were writing that ASARCO is sort of an institution there for better and for worse. There have been several environmental issues related to the plant.
Exactly. Before they opened the copper refinery, they ran a zinc smelter for half a century there. They had to settle a lawsuit over emissions from that plant. And then, much more notoriously, they had a facility in El Paso that spewed pollution on both sides of the Rio Grande for 100 years.
How do you see this playing out? Does the union, the representatives that you spoke to, are they optimistic?
I mean, I would say that they, you know, their resolve is steely, right? I mean, everyone told me that they'll do this as long as it takes. They've got a big strike fund. They're getting support from other unions, including the auto workers who struck in Arlington last year, if you recall. Mm-hmm. So they're getting lots of support. They have a strike fund. They're prepared to keep in the long haul. But again, federal regulators will have a say in how this plays out. So
what about ASARCO? What do they have to say?
They would not respond to any calls or emails. So I had to rely on a financial presentation to investors, which basically got across the idea that they want to cut costs in their North American operation. That was about all it said.
They're determined to cut costs in their North American operation. You can read all about it in the Texas Observer. That's where Gus Bova is a reporter. We'll link to his latest piece over at texasstandard.org. Gus, thanks again for speaking with us on our program. We appreciate it.
All right. Thank you.
Support for Texas Standard comes from White Mountain Bulgarian Yogurt, family-owned and operated in Austin, Texas for 40 years. Learn about the value of eating traditional Bulgarian yogurt at whitemountainfoods.com, available in the dairy aisle.
From the Texas Newsroom, I'm Lauren Tarrazas. The group Every Town for Gun Safety will pump $8 million into Texas races to elect gun control advocates in 2020. Shannon Watts is the founder of Moms Demand Action, which is part of Every Town. She says they want to flip the Texas House for Democrats and support congressional candidates.
In the United States House, we will work to reelect gun sense champions like Lizzie Bletcher in Texas 07 and Colin Allred in Texas 32. And elect gun sense candidates in other key congressional seats.
Democratic presidential candidate Michael Bloomberg co-founded and is a financial backer of Every Town. Texas Democrats are divided on whether they support a universal health care plan that would eliminate private health insurance. That's according to a new UT Austin, Texas Tribune poll. KUT's Ashley Lopez reports the current frontrunner in the Texas Democratic primary, Senator Bernie Sanders, is running on a platform that could get rid of most private health insurance plans.
Sanders' marquee health plan, also known as Medicare for All, would move all Americans onto publicly funded health plans. Pollsters found that 70% of Texas Democrats surveyed said they do want a universal health care system. But Jim Henson, who co-directed the poll, says among those who prefer a universal system, 18% said they would oppose a plan that eliminates the option of private health insurance.
And that's where we saw the division really come out, and in the problematic context for Democrats, in that about a fifth of Democrats oppose doing away with private health insurance. And so there's not a consensus there.
Texas voters in general are split on whether they want to change the country's current healthcare system at all. The poll found 46% of Texans said they preferred the current system, and 41% said they would prefer a universal program financed by taxpayers. Henson said the split was mostly along party lines. I'm Ashley Lopez in Austin.
New research from the Urban Institute shows low-income and immigrant communities continue to have concerns about the 2020 census. The think tank's national survey found 40% of adults in immigrant families think it's extremely or very likely that the census will be used to find undocumented immigrants, despite federal laws preventing this. Urban Institute researcher Michael Cartman.
The people who are really feel most vulnerable are the ones who have the least amount of trust that their answers to the census won't be used in this way.
A 1% undercount in Texas could cost the state $300 million a year in federal funding, according to the Center for Public Policy Priorities. I'm Lauren Terrazas for the Texas Standard.
Support for these Texas headlines comes from Abilene Christian University. Focusing on student success within key areas like service learning, first-year experiences, and learning communities. More at acu.edu.
This is the Texas Standard. If you want to know what it's like to be stuck on a cruise ship off the Japanese coast, a ship where thousands of passengers are quarantined because of the coronavirus, and who wouldn't, all you need to do is open YouTube or Instagram. Even in China, where saying the wrong thing on social media can get you in serious trouble, news, fear, and anger are all being spread online. The World Health Organization has called it a social media infodemic. That's their word. Our tech expert Omar Gayaga has been following the way people are responding to coronavirus on social media. Hello there, Omar.
Hey, David. Thanks for having me.
I don't suppose I consider it that big of a surprise, frankly, that something like the coronavirus spread would be spread on social media as a kind of an epidemic unto itself.
No, but it feels like the first time that we're seeing it kind of unfold in real time in a way that, you know, with SARS was so long ago, it was before social media.
Before social media, yeah.
And even with Zika, you know, which was feels like it was just a few years ago, really didn't kind of roll out with the kind of news and eyewitness things that we're seeing with this one.
Well, the idea, I guess, with social media, as it was in its own day with radio and with television, was that you could get the information out there quicker, and that perhaps the spread of the word would help try to, you know, stem the spread of the virus itself. What is the general consensus when it comes to whether social media is actually helping or hurting when it comes to the spread of this virus?
Definitely that it's a double-edged sword. Definitely that in some ways it's great that the graveness of the situation has gotten out more quickly, that we're getting the seriousness of it and seeing firsthand these accounts out of China, but also that, you know, a lot of misinformation is being spread, a lot of bad advice is being spread, a lot of racially tinged information or culturally, you know, bad information is being spread, which, again, you know, the World Health Organization is having to counter that as well as the actual, you know, disease.
Well, before we go much further, let's talk about that aspect of the racially tinged and the culturally incorrect and insensitive stuff. What sort of stuff are we talking about?
Kind of, you know, blaming the culture of, you know, oh, well, it's because of you know, what they're eating or how they live, and you know, which has a very racial overtone to it. And also that, well, you know, it's going to hit that country, but not us because we don't live that way. And it's a lot of really ugly kind of things like that. But then, you know, as you see it spreading to other places, you see that obviously that's not the case.
Is this just happening in the United States? Is it happening worldwide? Where is this? What about China, where, you know, you say the wrong thing there and then you can get in a whole lot of hurt?
What's been interesting is I think again, the graveness and the scale of it has actually led to people opening up more than you would expect out of China. Mm. You know, we had the situation with the doctor who first kind of announced, you know, who also had kind of alerted the world to SARS,
right,
back in the day. He, you know, got this attention for trying to tell people how serious this was and that it spreads from person to person.
And then he died.
And then eventually he died. And then what you saw in China was this outcry after his death that his death was being covered up, that he was being blamed for this. And then, you know, kind of the government kind of backtracking a bit and then proclaiming him as a hero for his work. So you do see a shift there where, you know, just the people that not willing to be silenced by this.
In China, the translation is a demand for transparency or greater transparency, at least from the government.
Yeah, absolutely.
I mentioned the passengers that were stranded on that cruise ship in Japan. Many of the Americans on board have now been evacuated, in fact, some to San Antonio. What did you notice about the way that the cruise passengers talked about their experience?
I think
you know, some of this has to do with just the tech that we're using now. It's just the speed of it, the quality of our phones and cameras, just kind of the immediacy of it, the kind of you are there feeling of it. Whereas, you know, maybe 5 years ago, it would not have felt as impactful, I don't think. And then also, you know, we're also seeing out of China kind of the hit to the supply chain and the hit to Apple and these companies that are going to affect us in other ways.
That's a big part of this story, and one that doesn't get a whole lot of attention. I mean, you have this impact on tech companies and their employees and customers. Apple, as I understand it, has already started factor in the coronavirus into its own earnings estimates, moving them downward, in fact. And there are workers who are off the job, and we're talking about a supply chain that goes way beyond Apple.
And this was all happening during Lunar New Year as well, where there was already kind of a shutdown of manufacturing for a period of time. And now this is adding to that. So you're going to see delays on, you know, smartphone manufacturing, smartwatches, game consoles even. I mean, which, you know, obviously is not as important as the human toll of this, but it is going to start to affect us in other ways. And we're going to start to see it in, you know, pricing and supply of electronics.
Yeah, it's funny because, you know, the president has been pushing for this, you know, made in the USA stuff, but the supply chain affects everything on down the line. And so there's no way we can sort of wall ourselves off from the impact of this particular virus. Omar Gayaga has been following the tech news related to all this over at techminutetexas.com. You can check him out over there. Omar, thanks so much for coming in. Good to see you, sir.
Thanks for having me, David.
Coming up on 39 minutes past the hour, Texas Standard Time. There's a whole lot more of the Standard just ahead. Stick around.
Support for Texas Standard comes from Galveston Island, celebrating spring break with golf beaches, seafood, and family-friendly attractions, including Moody Gardens, dolphin-watching adventures, and more. Details at galveston.com. Support for Texas Standard comes from Texas Oncology, a network of more than 460 physicians who deliver cancer-fighting treatments and compassionate care to more than 50,000 new cancer patients each year. More at texasoncology.com.
Hey, it's the Texas Standard. I'm David Brown. Great to have you with us. More than a few country songs have picked up on that feeling you get when you realize something so everyday, something you take in as a given, should have been cherished before it was gone. From the Texas Standard's Heel to Toe Project comes Just Such a Story.
My name is Martha Kubina Benevelli, and my story starts when I was a little girl in Rosenberg, Texas. My dad grew up during the Depression. I think that gave him a good, strong spirit that carried him forward. In the 1950s, he opened a boot shop in Rosenberg, Texas, and began making handmade cowboy boots. The shop was called the Kubina Boot Shop. At the time, I wasn't even in school yet, so I spent my days in the back of the shop playing with the leather scraps and watching him sew together cowboy boots. I remember scraps of reds and some yellows and spools of heavy thread. Just the feel of the leather, the smell of it. It was fun to play with as a kid. At one point, I remember my dad made a pair of boots that went to the White House, and I'm not sure who they were sent to at the White House, but he was always very proud of that fact. It always brought a smile to his face when he talked about it. Later on, he made pairs of boots for each of his daughters, and I was the youngest, so I got this little pair of black and white boots, and I can remember loving them very much and enjoying them very much. Eventually, he sold the boot shop. He set up a cotton gin in Guy, Texas. He owned some apartments. He owned a couple of laundromats. And at some point, there were no more of his boots left in our family, which was kind of disappointing. But he fortunately ran into a lady years later that had one of his pair of boots. I think it was a lady he went to church with. And he convinced her to sell the boots to him, which he did, and they ended up on a shelf in his house for a long, long time, and he was always very proud of that pair of boots. When he died in 1997, one of those boots went to me, and the other one went to my oldest sister, And that's how I ended up having a half a pair of boots. I'm really proud to have that single boot, and I've always wished that I had that little black and white pair that I had when I was a little girl. I also wished that bootmakers were required to sign their boots, because I suspect that there are other Kabina boots walking around that I just don't know about because they're not signed. My name is Martha Kubina Benevelli, and that was my story and my daddy's story.
You know, if there's one thing we've learned with this project, it's that Texans don't just wear any old boots. They wear boots that speak to them. So, hey, speak to us. Tell us your boot story by emailing texasstandard@kut.org, because them boots ain't going to speak for themselves. If you've ever spent time in an intensive care unit, perhaps to be close to a loved one, you know how the anxiety coupled with that constant beeping of monitors and the bustle of doctors can be overwhelming. Well, as part of an ongoing focus on mental health called On Our Minds, KERA's Courtney Collins reports now on how this anxiety can be intensified for parents who've spent time in the neonatal ICU and the feelings that linger, sometimes even after the baby comes home.
Kepley Wakefield approaches life with typical 13-month-old vigor. A lot of smiling, excellent crawling acceleration, some shrieking. Her parents, Courtney and Hollis, cherish her. They were by her side for each of the 95 days Kepley spent in the NICU.
I had some bleeding at 21 weeks. So at that point, they put me on bed rest and we were having really difficult conversations because viability is considered 24. So we had like 2.5 or 3 weeks to get through, which was a really, really scary time.
Hollis knew her pregnancy was going to be high risk. She was a 39-year-old cervical cancer survivor, so she and her wife had a plan for early labor. Even they weren't prepared for delivery at 24 weeks, 5 days. But that's when Kepley arrived, at 1 pound, 10 ounces. The NICU team braced the Dallas couple for a long and frustrating road.
They told us it would be like a roller coaster. They were like, it's going to be, you know, minute to minute some days. It's not a straight line at all.
And it wasn't. Kepley started out in the NICU at UT Southwestern's Clements University Hospital, but eventually moved to the higher-level NICU just down the road at Children's Medical Center in Dallas. She was on a ventilator for 3 months. When she was discharged, she was still tiny, just 4 pounds, 11 ounces. She still needed supplementary oxygen and had weekly doctor's appointments. Courtney says the stress from the NICU followed them home.
I'm anxious all the time. I have said I have not been myself since Kepley was born.
Because Kepley was born so early, her lungs weren't fully developed. And because a ventilator helped her breathe for so long, those tiny lungs were also damaged. So even though Kepley is now thriving, flu season is a real threat. Her parents second-guess every public outing, even quick trips to the store.
And you're thinking, do we risk it? Are we both going to be home where one of us could stay home? Just kind of having to deal with that, even just for like day-to-day tasks that we might normally bring a baby to. You know, we're having to kind of think twice.
And that's not an overreaction. Doctors say catching a respiratory virus like RSV or the flu might put a premature baby right back in the hospital, which could re-traumatize those parents who've already spent time in the NICU. Dr. Rashman Savani is the chief of neonatal medicine at Children's Health. He says even just the noise of endlessly beeping NICU monitors can overwhelm parents.
The medical team and the nursing team, they're phenomenal. They understand what all these beeps are and when to respond, when to not respond. But the family is bombarded with this sort of cacophony of alarms. And they're all designed to say, hey, pay attention to me. But for the family, it's really scary.
Which is one of the reasons Children's Health has a support crew in place to handle everything but the medicine. Every family has access to a team that includes a social worker, a psychologist, and a chaplain.
Whether it's financial or stress or tests their faith, this family support team is designed to sort of alleviate that shock that they get when they end up in the NICU.
Dr. Savani says Children's Health also has a team devoted to helping a family transition to home, learning the ins and outs of complicated equipment and medication, as well as making sure the house is set up for a preemie, without the constant surveillance of doctors and nurses.
And I actually call it, you know, you're cutting the umbilical cord the second time. And it's a very scary thing for parents to go through.
Hollis and Courtney Wakefield have been there. And while some things about caring for a preemie are old hat by now, they say some of those visceral NICU memories will never fade. There's a visual reminder in the house, too. A strand of colorful beads, so long it could wrap around Kepley's tiny waist a dozen times. Courtney says each bead stands for something different Kepley went through in the NICU.
A blood draw, or a surgery, or some sort of event that she had to endure during her stay.
One day, Kepley might decide to hang these beads on the wall, a memento of her earliest triumph.
Does that feel good? I know teethers.
For now, though, she's happy to use them as a teething toy. I'm Courtney Collins in Dallas.
Support for Texas Standard comes from Rand Group, partnering with small and mid-sized companies by helping to unify their businesses and achieve digital transformation. More at randgroup.com. Software delivered as promised. No surprises.
This is the Texas Standard. I'm David Brown. In 2016, Harris County District Attorney Kim Ogg became the first Democrat in nearly 40 years to be elected for the top prosecutor job in Houston. Ogg's pitch at the time resonated with voters, positioning herself as a criminal justice reformer. But 4 years later, Ogg faces a tough Democratic primary. As Houston Public Media's Andrew Schneider explains, some progressive Democrats feel Ogg failed them.
To understand why there are strong feelings about bail reform, consider what happened to Carlos Caldwell. He lives in public housing in Houston's Third Ward. Until a year ago, Caldwell worked as a substitute teacher. Then he was pulled over for not having a front license plate, told he had a warrant for passing a bad check, and was arrested. Caldwell says he didn't do it. He waited in jail for 4 days without seeing a judge until finally he learned the details of his case from another inmate's attorney.
And I know the bond is $100. I don't have any family here. I really don't have any friends here. And I don't have $100. He said, well, if you plead not guilty, it's going to take about 2 weeks and they have to go to trial. And so you'll be here for 2 more weeks.
Caldwell says he was terrified, so he pled guilty, thinking that would be the end of it. It wasn't. Caldwell lost his job, then his home. It's stories like Caldwell's that outrage advocates of criminal justice reform, advocates like Tanyunique Smith. I asked Smith if she knew how she planned to vote in the upcoming DA's primary.
I do, not to vote for Kim Ogg.
I spoke with Smith at a meeting of Harris County Commissioner's Court, where she and others came to argue against Ogg's request for an increase in funding to pay for more prosecutors. Like Caldwell, Smith found herself in jail for a crime she says she didn't commit and pled guilty to get out when she couldn't afford bail. She, too, has been unemployed ever since. She blames Kim Ogg, who, as DA, opposed a plan to eliminate cash bail for indigent defendants and allow them to bond out on their own recognizance.
I'm going to be pushing for Audia Jones because she understands what goes on in the African-American and Latino community, and she understands how the court system is not favorable to those populations in the community.
Democratic candidate Audia Jones has the endorsement of a number of progressive groups, including the Texas Organizing Project and the Houston GLBT Caucus. The latter is especially significant given Ogg is the first openly LGBT DA in Houston's history. Bob Stein teaches political science at Rice University.
Now the Democrats have such control of Harris County that they can look to an incumbent and say, you know what, if you haven't towed the line on things that we think are important, we have no problem running against you because we're not going to lose a seat to a Republican.
Ogg opposed bail reform in large part because she said it didn't do enough to protect crime victims. And some of those crime victims are strong supporters of Kim Ogg.
And the earth opened up and I had to deposit my son.
That's gun control activist Calandria Kemp addressing last week's Mike Bloomberg rally at the Buffalo Soldiers Museum. Kemp lost her only son, George Kemp Jr., to gun violence. She says Kim Ogg responded when Kemp brought to her attention a group of mothers who had seen no progress in their children's murder cases.
I just know that from that experience, DA Ogg, she really listened. She really had compassion for these families, and she was really about the victims' voices, about doing what was right, not just only for defendants, but for the victims that are left behind.
Kemp says change is necessary to unclog the courts, allowing them to focus on violent crimes rather than nonviolent defenders. But she says Ogg has been doing that, particularly through the use of diversion programs.
For me, I'm going to go and vote for DA Ogg continue because I want to see the work that she does continue.
As for Carlos Caldwell, he's still trying to make up his mind, but he says bail reform will shape his choice.
Because there are a lot of people such as myself that have pled guilty to things they're innocent of so that they don't have to stay 14 extra days in jail to plead not guilty.
Early voting has already begun. Primary day is March 3rd. In Houston, I'm Andrew Schneider.
And you are listening to the Texas Standard. Social mediator Wells Dunbar is back with more of what Texans are saying on this Thursday, and what are they saying?
Well, David, you asked if last night's debate, the Democratic presidential debate, moved the needle for anyone out there, and we are hearing plenty of responses via Twitter to that question. Yeah, let's check out a few of them. Alejandro Villagas, he says that the debate was a disaster. He adds that watching very smart and great candidates tear into each other was cringy. The only winners were the broadcasters and Trump. And I noticed that Trump, the president himself, was making a little bit of hay out of the bloodletting, if you will.
On Twitter?
On Twitter.
You
today.
Don't say.
Yes. AJ says that it did move the needle because Elizabeth Warren, exposed Bloomberg on national TV about NDAs, those non-disclosure agreements we were talking about earlier, stop and frisk, and plenty more. Bloomberg was a deer in the headlights.
He did not look exactly like a prepared candidate. And his communications folks were saying, look, he didn't prepare. He's been out there campaigning, doing the retail politics stuff.
I saw someone refer to it as a sort of hazing. Like, this is the first debate.
you got to go through this to stand on this stage.
Jumped into the gang, I guess.
Yeah. But, it's funny how people's memories don't really linger. I mean, come the next debate, I wonder how many people are going to be talking about, you know, who did well in this debate. I mean, you just think about it.
Yeah, definitely. So apparently it did change things for one other tweeter here, Neil Ellis Orts. Neil writes that the main thing the debate did for me was move me away from the concept of blue no matter who. If Bloomberg gets the nomination, I don't know what I'll do. So definitely, just lots of talk. Being the center of attention, being the lightning rod, obviously obviously raises the stakes.
That's an interesting comment, though. If Bloomberg gets a nomination, I don't know what I'll do. That's a scenario that a lot of Texas Democrats are really quite concerned about, right? I mean, because Mike Bloomberg has been advancing in the Texas polls. And if someone like this particular Democrat, I assume this person is a Democrat, decides that he will not be able to vote for Bloomberg, that could really bring down some turnout at the polls.
Yeah, and definitely, and we're hearing that on the other side as well with people opposed to Bernie Sanders' candidacy.
Yeah.
So really kind of a battle for the direction of the control of the Democratic Party. Well, David, are you a Samsung user? I know you're not beholden to the iPhone.
No, I'm not. I am a Samsung user.
Did you get one of these weird messages last night? Because I'm seeing some
Wait
talk
a minute.
About
I
this.
Did get a weird message. Okay. What weird message are you talking about?
Yeah, Samsung users across Texas and the U.S., they got this strange message last night. It was through the phone's Find My Mobile app.
That was the one. And it had like three letters or something, like A12 or something.
I think it was just the letter one.
Was that what it was? Okay.
Yeah. So tech website Mashable, they note that this message was most likely some sort of test on Samsung's part.
I wondered if someone was trying to break into my phone when I saw Find My Phone.
Like,
what's this about?
Find My Mobile. Yeah. But no, it was apparently some sort of test or something.
Gosh.
But Samsung hasn't really straightened
things
out there. Yeah. You're not the only one who got that goofy one. Julie Lucas says it was disconcerting, to say the least, because didn't it show up around like midnight or something?
I don't know. I got up. I was sort of groggy this morning, I saw it, and as soon as I clicked on it, it disappeared, and I thought, what just happened? All right. Listen, we're out of time for the big broadcast. I guess we can all rest easier that someone wasn't trying to break into our phones after all, I assume. I don't know. Try to keep up with this stuff. You can always keep up with the news over at texasstandard.org. And we're going to be back here for the big broadcast tomorrow. Hope you can join us. Till then, I'm David, along with Wells, wishing you a terrific Thursday.
Support for Texas Standard comes from TCU, dedicated to improving healthcare in North Texas and around the world through pursuits like the new TCU and UNTHSC School of Medicine, educating empathetic scholars. TCU, lead on. Philanthropic support for Texas Standard comes from Casey and Scott O'Hare, the Winkler Family Foundation, Lynn Dobson and Greg Waldridge, Adrian Killam, the George Huntington Family, and the Cynthia and George Mitchell Foundation.